The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the detective's dictum. To catch a thief, think like a thief. To prevent a crime, you have to case a joint like a potential infiltrator. Look for the weak spots, the air shafts, sewer tunnels, exposed walls and rooftops that become scenes of crimes and getaways, which means you have to think like an architect. That is one tactic, anyway, played out with a mad scientist delight by Jeff Mano in A Burglar's Guide to the City. The book gives readers a pair of X-ray glasses, presenting the built environment through the eyes of former bank robbers, cops, FBI agents, and panic room builders, among others, along with the mechanics of some historic heists. And Jeff Mano, who is not a burglar, but author of Building Blog and the book, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I think this is the first book that I've ever seen categorized as architecture slash true crime.
I was secretly delighted to see that, actually. It's not a combination you run into very often.
But you do make a point that burglary requires architecture. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's an interesting crime because you can't have burglary without buildings. So it literally requires an individual to be inside a structure of some kind in order to be considered a burglar. And so burglary is legally defined by its relationship to architecture, but also has a kind of technical relationship to the built environment that I found really fascinating, which is that burglars look at buildings in ways that homeowners or architects themselves tend not to. So they'll see a front door, but that will be the very thing that they'll avoid. They'll see a wall, but instead of assuming that it's something they're meant to walk along, they'll try to get through it. They'll even find a way to cut down through a roof or other ways to access or engage with architecture that is much more aggressive and much more hands-on, but is a kind of an alternative way of dealing with buildings. And so all of that really made me want to look at architecture and cities from the point of view of a burglar to understand what they see and how it reveals something different. You know, where you and I might see the aesthetics of a building or the historic references of the ornaments on the outside of a building, a burglar will see a convenient handhold or a place to hide. And that was a point of view I really wanted to explore more with the book.
We meet a lot of successful and not so successful criminals in your book. One of them, the ingenious George Leonidas Leslie. He studied architecture in Cincinnati before coming to New York in 1869. Could have made it probably as a legitimate architect, but became a master thief. Why?
The psychological reasons are, you could debate those, I think, endlessly. What's interesting, I think, is how he realized that the skills he had as an architect, that he was able to understand how a building could be constructed, how its internal systems would work, was also perfect knowledge for a burglar, that if he could build something, he could also break into something. There's something really interesting about that, I think, because, we tend to trust architects. You know, why would you mistrust somebody who comes along and says that they have been working on a building or they're designing a house and they would love to see the blueprints of your house? They're trying to understand maybe how to put a wraparound porch or how the master bedroom could fit above the garage. But what Leslie was doing when he asked those same kinds of questions in the 19th century cornering bankers at cocktail parties and asking to see their blueprints was that he was a kind of amassing spatial information about the city so that he could case buildings better. He would draw his own plans of the buildings that he would walk through. He would, as I mentioned, take a look at other people's blueprints. And eventually he really kind of had architectural knowledge of the East Coast that was so extensive that at one point his bank crew was so good they were behind 80% of all the bank crime in the United States, which is almost every crime of breaking and entering from a bank point of view of that era, which really shows that architectural knowledge when put to the wrong end can be a really effective tool for criminals.
One of the other things that you write about him is that he would create these elaborate scale models of constructions right down to the furniture.
Yeah, it was really an impressive undertaking, and kind of revealed that, that this was his way of going into architecture. So rather than avoiding an architectural career, he just sort of created his own alternative path. But so, yeah, he worked with a colleague, a really interesting woman in her own right, who was named Mar Mandelbaum. She was a fence who would sell his stolen goods. But she had a series of warehouses over in Brooklyn, and this is where he would build extremely elaborate three-dimensional models of the banks that they would attack. And so, as you mentioned, it would be down all the way to the furniture. So if there was a table or a chair that they had to avoid and not bump into in the middle of the night, he would actually have his cohorts train in the darkness with a stopwatch until they were so good that they weren't bumping into anything. And it was only after they had mastered the art of the heist on these kind of surrogate interiors that they would then head out and actually hit the bank that they were actually targeting.
So in order to prevent thievery, you have to know how a thief would plan things out, like this former burglar from Toronto that you met and spoke with. What was his trick? How did he infiltrate buildings?
Yeah, he was a really interesting individual and certainly the most creative burglar or former burglar that I spoke to for the book. But he also revealed that we are surrounded by vulnerabilities that we don't see, and sometimes because those vulnerabilities are invisible. So what I mean by that was that he realized that he could actually use the city's fire code as a targeting mechanism. So he was so creative in his approach that he had memorized how fire code shaped buildings, how it regulated the design of interiors, how it tried to keep people safe by putting apartment doors a certain fixed distance from emergency escape stairs inside of a building, to even what floors have alarmed doors for those same emergency escapes. And he could have a pretty accurate understanding of how a building was designed and how many people lived in it and even how big the apartments were, all without setting foot inside the building. And so this notion that the very code of the city can be turned into a burglar's tool was really, sort of flipped my understanding of the city on its head, and also revealed that something that is meant to protect us, something that is meant to keep us safe in a fire so that we can escape and get outside to the street without being caught up in an inferno, can, if used by the wrong people, be turned into something much more sinister as a way in. So similar to George Leonidas Leslie, who realized that his knowledge of how banks are constructed could be used to become an ideal bank robber, this individual in Toronto really kind of revealed that everything about a city, if looked at from the wrong, illicit, or devious angle, can be turned into something that we need protection from.
So now he's working in home security. But yeah. You run down through a number of almost tragicomic would-be burglars getting trapped in air shafts or pet doors or between sheets of drywall. But one called the Roofman was much more adept. What was the key to his success?
Yeah, Roofman was another really interesting and creative individual whose modus operandi was that he would break into chain stores and fast food restaurants. And he had realized that in the repetitive floor plans of things like McDonald's or Toys R Us, and in the regulated schedule of employee events where you would open the register at a certain time of day or count the cash at the end of the day, these all happened at very specific times and in floor plans that could be memorized and would be repeated throughout the country. And so effectively, you know, I compare it to Groundhog Day. He could break into one McDonald's, and if he did that, it was the same as breaking into any other McDonald's, and he would do it at the same time of day to the same kinds of franchised businesses. And eventually, you know, his moniker Roofman came because he had not yet been arrested at the time, but he would break in through the roof. He would cut a hole down through the ceiling, drop down into the kitchen in more or less the same place, and then go about his robbery. But so it's really interesting that, you know, he found a flaw in repetition, that he was able to point out that if all of your floor plans are the same, the vulnerabilities will be the same. And in fact, the Toronto burglar pointed out something very similar, which was that when you go to a new development suburb where the houses are built to a similar floor plan, except for maybe they're mirrored or maybe they have a, you know, a bonus room above the garage or that kind of thing. If you know how to break into one house, you basically know how to break into every house in the neighborhood. And so when you think about it from that point of view, you begin to realize that actually there is a way of looking at architecture that is pretty unique to the burglar that can reveal some of some aspects of the ways that we can learn to protect ourselves or the vulnerabilities that we are surrounded by that we might not have noticed before.
My guest is Jeff Maino. He writes about architecture and design, and he travels into the underworld for perspective on how criminals and those tasked with stopping them look at our built environment. His research included learning to pick locks, riding along with an LAPD helicopter, and getting schooled in the art of the getaway from a former bank robber. The book is called The Burglar's Guide to the City. Well, Jeff, as I mentioned, not only burglars finding ways into buildings, but law enforcement. the FBI TACOPS team especially, they're sort of experts at getting into buildings. What are some of their tactics?
That was the funny part of the research, was the realization that a lot of these skills are repeated on the law enforcement side. And so breaking and entering becomes something that is not just limited to burglars, but is actually something that the police, the FBI, ATF, and even fire crews do. But so in terms of the FBI, what you mentioned, there's a really fascinating program that was actually referred to as Operation Stagehand. And so that sounds very pompous and kind of theatrical, but that's actually what it was. It's part of the FBI where you will have elaborate props to hide the fact that you're actually breaking into a mob warehouse to install a microphone. There's actually things that sound like something straight out of a Monty Python sketch. There's a fake umbrellas where when you open the umbrella, it actually looks as if a piece of shrubbery has appeared. And so you can hide behind the bush and use that to give cover to a breaking and entering operation. Or there'll be elaborate costumes so that you look like you work for the gas company or the cable company, and that you'll pop open a manhole so that it looks as if you're, you know, working with infrastructure, but you're actually tapping into a phone line. And so those kinds of things are both theatrical and interesting, but they extend all the way to the kinds of tools that the FBI will use to get into a building. And so, one of the things that interests me there was that I had thought that I would find amongst lockpickers a kind of insight into how one might enter a building without using keys. But in reality, the people who are truly good at that are law enforcement teams, you know, who are need to get into a building as fast as possible because they know there is a suspect. They knew they need to capture the suspect before they can flush the evidence or fire back or that kind of thing. And so they've developed a whole series of specialty tools that, if they were to fall into the hands of burglars, would effectively eliminate any sense of security you might have. And so the existence of those tools is something that I really focus on in with one of the chapters of the book. And I found actually one of the most fascinating parts of the research process.
So that's one of the quick ways to combat crime, but there's also a kind of long game for criminals and for law enforcement, almost like a sting or a con in some cases, like in Britain, the capture houses. So what's going on there?
The capture houses are really fascinating. Capture houses are fake apartments run by the police to capture burglars. And so they're actually fully furnished. They even have everyday possessions scattered around to look as if they're a real apartment. But what the police have done is that they will deliberately engineer it so that it corresponds to a known burglar's method of attack. So they'll put a laptop out on the kitchen table and make it look as if the owner's just stepped out for dinner. But they'll also leave a window open so that it's just cracked maybe an inch or two, but just enough to tempt somebody to crawl up and open that window and slip inside. But then they've covered everything, though, with a UV visible tagant, so a spray or a liquid that they'll put on door handles or on the laptop, so that when they then shine a light on anyone who has touched those things, they'll find that they're covered in this glowing liquid. And then, of course, they have surveillance cameras throughout the apartment. But so capture houses are interesting because on one level, they are engineered towards one specific person. You know, if you have one burglar active in a neighborhood or a city, they can be single-handedly responsible for the crime statistics going through the roof. So you try to master exactly what that burglar is hitting, and then you construct exactly what they're looking for. It's almost like a hunting expedition. And then you just simply wait for them to pounce. And so, you know, capture houses have been hit literally within 24 hours of being constructed. Other times it's been more than a year and no one has hit it yet. But so it's a really interesting example of how police are using architecture and design to capture burglars with the same level of innovation that you might have assumed only existed with people like George Leonidas Leslie. So it really is kind of an arms race or like a design war that goes off back and forth between law enforcement and the criminals they're trying to track.
So you show us this solid, orderly metropolis, and underneath this, or a parallel, a hidden one. Is that the way you find yourself looking at things now? I mean, do you walk into a bank and start looking at where the cameras are and thinking, could I rob this joint?
Well, absolutely. Those are details I notice. You know, I notice it when I visit the homes of friends or family. It's the kind of thing I notice when I walk down the street. It's definitely something that I see when I go into an art museum now or am at the bank to deposit a check or that kind of thing. But it's exciting. I mean, I think that the goal there is not to become a burglar or to actually plot a future crime. I think the notion is that suddenly now the city reveals itself as a puzzle that you've lived in all along and you've never noticed. And there are these three-dimensional possibilities that exist where, you know, you can connect one building to the next by going through the sewers, or you can connect an entire neighborhood to the next by following an abandoned subway line. And that if you start noticing how things are connected this way in this alternative underground world that you mentioned, I think it's a really exciting, both intellectually and spatially, to realize that, in fact, the world has more possibilities than we think. And we tend to take it for granted that architects built something in a certain way and that we need to follow the hallways they built and use the doors they put there for us. But in fact, cities present infinite possibilities for movement and connection and exploration. And I think that that's another aspect of thinking like a burglar, is the realization that, there's a lot more to do with the world, and the city offers more routes of things to see and do than we tend to assume.
Well, Jeff Mino, thank you for this alternative view.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Jeff Mino, he's author of Building Blog and now A Burglar's Guide to the City. You'll find more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Film studios all have signature logos to start off their movies. Paramount's, that ring of stars over a snow-capped peak, is the oldest surviving Hollywood film logo. Pixar shows an animated desk lamp that hops into the frame and becomes the letter I in its name. Producer Nate DeMeo from the podcast The Memory Palace brings us the history of MGM's roaring logo.
They took a lion cub from the Nubian desert, and they put him in the movies. They called him Jackie, trained him to sit and come on command, to rear up, to look fierce but not be fierce. They kept him well fed so he wouldn't eat anyone. And they made Jackie chase Tarzan through the jungles of the Los Angeles Arboretum. Menace Jane from the edge of the shallow concrete pond dressed with palm fronds and ferns. Around the corner from the ersatz suburbs on the MGM backlot, where he scampered about for the cameras until some director called cut and had sufficient footage to make it appear that Jackie was chasing Laurel and or Hardy. In some morning in 1927, he was led out of his cage, led through the lot where the showgirls in sequins shuffled off to their 7:15 call, walked amidst extras in togas and cowboy hats, and was led to a soundstage where he hopped up on two crates, one for his back paws, one for his front paws, looked into the camera, leaned into a microphone, and roared. That roar would be heard hundreds of times a day at thousands of movie theaters across the movie mad world. It was the late 1920s, and the movies were it. They were the thing you did. Everyone, every demographic, everywhere. There were 20,000 theaters in the U.S. alone. There were vast movie palaces with velvet curtains and gilt ceilings, balconies and orchestras and loges and tuxedoed ushers in every big city. And there were silver screens and folding chairs and storefronts and old vaudeville halls in just about every hill and holler. A nickel, a dime, for a feature or two, a newsreel, shorts, cartoons, a couple of coins for a whole evening's entertainment, for a whole afternoon's childcare. And now with sound. There was sound now. Broadway melodies, thundering cavalry, cannonades, tap shoes, sighing lovers, captured forever, like Jackie, roaring. At the beginning of every MGM picture, 10 seconds in time, captured forever. And relived again and again and again, duplicated, spliced onto reel after reel after reel, familiar to just about every man, woman, and child in the United States and beyond for decades. Officially, Jackie was Leo. That's the MGM lion's name. It's nom de marketing. Jackie was the second Leo. The first was named Slats. And he didn't roar. It was the silent era, so he just kind of looked around. But Jackie roared. And people loved him for it. The idea was rock solid. People love Leo, and people love planes. It was the summer of 1927. Lindbergh had landed in Paris in May. Aviators were in the papers all the time. New speed records, endurance records, altitude records. X guy flew from X place to Y place for the first time. So it's July or August, and someone at the publicity office at MGM says, "What if we put Leo in a plane?" And it was basically the best idea anyone had ever heard. He'd be the first animal, non-human category, to fly non-stop cross-country. The publicity would be amazing. So they found a pilot, a famous one, who'd just come in second in a race from California to Honolulu, which was the kind of thing that could make you famous in 1927. They found a plane, which was the same model as Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis, and they tricked it out, put in state-of-the-art navigation systems, and built a special cage for Jackie. He wouldn't be able to turn around, because any shift in weight could disrupt the flight. But he could handle it for the 20 hours or so it would take to go from San Diego to New York. Not that they asked Jackie. And the press and the public ate it up and descended upon a Southern California airfield to wish their beloved Leo bon voyage. And the voyage was going totally bon until they flew over Arizona. And the famous pilot dipped down to wave to a relative as he passed near her house and couldn't regain altitude. And he clipped a tree. And the plane went down in the middle of the Arizona desert. Jackie survived. You can breathe easy. The plane broke up, but the cage remained intact. And the famous pilot left him some sandwiches and water. And 4 days later, he came back with some cowboys and found Jackie hungry but healthy. It was a bad look for MGM, nearly killing its mascot. But there is no bad publicity, right? And so Leo the Lion became Leo the Lucky, and Jackie went on tour. No plane this time. He was driven in a custom-made 24-foot-long car, outfitted with a gilded cage with room to turn around. He traveled in a three-car caravan with a 54-note circus calliope, and a trainer, and a manager, and valets, who were there, they said, to attend to his every need. He ate fine cuts of fine meat. He wanted for nothing, they said. They knew they had nearly killed him in that plane crash, and they were going to do right by him from here on out. Right by him, it seems, was taking him on a 40,000-mile journey through 38 states for 3 years straight. Right by him, it seems, was riding in an open cage on state roads at speeds, though safe, where not speeds a lion was born to travel. Right by him, it seems, were stops in 1,418 cities and towns, where he did things he was not born to do. There was nothing instinctual, nothing lion-like, nothing that had been encoded in his DNA by generations upon generations of natural selection about being made to roar on command, to not roar despite his desires, to offer his big paw to small-town bigwigs, to entertain at orphanages, to attend ribbon cuttings, to bring an odd joy to thousands upon thousands of human beings who flocked to town squares and village greens to see this celebrity from the silver screen. While he sat like a dog, when he was not a dog, bred to want human companionship, to want to be pet, to be somehow pleased by pleasing people. I'm sure some of these people were cruel, because they were people. I don't trust a boy in a Michigan roadside in 1929, 1930, not to test his arm and test what happens when you hit the only lion you were ever going to see in your town, the rock. And I'm sure there were times when the nights were too cold, when the crosswinds were too strong on some county road out of Eau Claire or Coeur d'Alene, when he had to sit too long while the mayor of Waxahachie or Carpinteria asked for a retake of his big photo op with the famous Leo because he was sure he'd blinked. But he was well fed and well cared for. His handlers were kind, within limits, historical and scientific. He would have been bad for business otherwise. He spent his retirement at the Philadelphia Zoo, where he died pretty young of a bad heart. There have been far worse lives led by African lions in North America. There were other Leos after Jackie. each made to do things they weren't born to do. But Jackie is still captured forever. You can see him at the beginning of the old movies. Catch him on TV now and then. You can search him on YouTube. That's Jackie in sepia tone at the start of The Wizard of Oz. And it's nice to see him there. But see him too. In a cage by the wreckage of a single-engine monoplane. In the middle of the Arizona desert. And I don't ask you to ignore the bars. See the bars. For he was captured forever. But see him there in the desert. Alert for predators. Scanning the horizon and the scrub brush for movement, for prey. Breathing desert air. Looking out at the stars, at the low rolling hills. No streetlights. No Hollywood sign. Doing what he was born to do.
And that story came to us from producer Nate DeMeo and the podcast The Memory Palace. You'll find a link to hear more stories from The Memory Palace at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In North Carolina, HB2, the so-called bathroom law, thrust gender identity and transnational rights into the national spotlight. If you don't know what I'm talking about, here's a little refresher.
We want to spend a few more minutes now on that controversial bathroom law that's gotten so much attention in North Carolina, or HB2.
What's gotten the most attention is a requirement that schools and government offices restrict bathrooms to the gender a person is born
with.
This
past week, President Obama wrote a letter telling every public school district in the country to let transgender students use the bathrooms that match their gender identity. At the center of the controversy is a question.
A quick primer here. Biological sex is what is on your birth certificate. Gender identity, which may or may not correspond, does not develop for years. For people who have had little to no exposure to the trans experience, the issue has come out of nowhere. But Jessica Winters isn't too surprised. She says society is reinforcing gender norms incorrectly, even before babies are born.
Have you all voted?
That's a clip from a viral gender reveal party video. Jessica Winter is features editor for Slate. In a recent article, she connected the rise of the gender reveal party to North Carolina's HB2 law. Jessica, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So for folks who have not seen one, what is a gender reveal party?
Gender reveal party is usually based around a gender reveal cake. And sometimes the parents will find out the sex of the fetus and make a cake that either has a pink interior or a blue interior, and then they cut it open at the party and reveal the sex of their soon-to-be baby to the celebrants. I think more often the parents themselves want to be surprised, and so they have their OBGYN or the sonogram technician just write the sex on a piece of paper. They slip it to a trusted baker, and then the baker can make the cake so that everyone is surprised at the party.
So they can be pretty creative, and for better or for worse, I guess I would say. What are some of the themes of these gender reveal parties?
I mean, some of these gender reveal parties are gorgeous affairs. There are cakes that you see that will have the tagline, who will I be open to see? And the cake is designed as this gorgeous package to be opened. And maybe there's pink wrapping inside and maybe there's blue. There are others that are a little more questionable. Some of the taglines might be rifles or ruffles, meaning if it's a boy, it's a rifle, and if it's a girl, it's a ruffle. Another one you see a lot is guns or glitter. And these are the ones that make me a little uncomfortable because they seem to assign boys with kind of violence and action and can-do-ness, and they assign girls kind of frilly embellishments and not a whole lot in the way of action. And, you know, you kind of want to just roll your eyes at it, but they're very popular, and they definitely reinforce these kind of gender norms that I don't think are particularly healthy.
Well, here's one growing trend. Couples pack a little box of explosive pink or blue chalk and then shoot it with a high-powered rifle. Let's hear a clip from YouTube.
Yep, go. Fire in the hole. That was sweet.
So the title of the party is maybe a little misleading. They're not really revealing gender, but sex, right?
Right. They're revealing biological chromosomal sex. I mean, chances are they are revealing gender. Generally speaking, sex and gender do correspond. But as we're learning, they don't always.
And maybe reveal more about what people think about gender. I mean, after such a public performance, it makes me wonder if there are expectations of how a child will behave.
I think so. And I think this is especially interesting with very little kids, like kids under the age of maybe 2 or 2.5. Those kids don't know what gender is. They don't have any inkling of what gender presentation might be or whether they're a boy or a girl. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but generally speaking, kids are just clueless about that until a certain age. And so I think it's more about parents projecting onto the children than actually guessing anything about the children.
Well, you're a mother of a daughter, I believe, young
yes.
daughter. What does being a parent reveal to you about how people view gender and sex in kids and babies?
I think the thing that's most striking to me, and I wrote about this a little bit in Slate, is if I've dressed my daughter, who's 18 months old, in, say, jeans and a T-shirt because we're going to the playground, people automatically assume she's a boy. And I never correct anyone because I don't care. But if they realize their mistake, they tend to be very apologetic, as if they've offended me somehow. Sometimes people are a little affronted that I have not signposted her as a girl more clearly, that I haven't put bows in her hair or I haven't put her in a pink dress. That speaks to me about a certain uneasiness we have about sex and gender in our culture that may or may not be expressed in these gender reveal parties as well.
Jessica Winter is with us. She's features editor for Slate. She wrote recently about the rise of the gender reveal party and how these parties relate to a somewhat deterministic view of gender in American culture. So when people ask if a child is a boy or a girl, I mean, do you think that's deterministic? Do you think that's the wrong question to ask?
I think it's rude. I hated it when strangers came up to me and asked me that question when I was visibly pregnant. And it's not because I was offended that they were blurring the line between sex and gender or any of that. I was offended because I did not like the idea of becoming public property because I was visibly pregnant. And I think that there is a parallel there with the bathroom controversy, because it's both of these situations are about the struggle to achieve privacy in public. A visibly pregnant woman doesn't have much privacy in public. A trans person who wants to use the right bathroom in North Carolina doesn't have much privacy in public because lawmakers are interrogating his or her right to do that. And so I think that's another strain here that we need to look at. I also, I hasten to add, though, that I think my experience was colored by living in New York City, where you just try to keep that tunnel vision and you don't really want to have a whole lot of impromptu interactions with strangers, particularly about your body.
Another part of our culture is how toys and clothing for boys and girls are marketed, often separated into binary aisles. How do clothing and toy marketers and manufacturers play into these gender expectations?
Well, I think we see that that's changing. I think a leader in that regard is Target. Target has definitely made an effort and received some backlash for the effort to kind of tamp down a little bit on the boy stuff and the girl stuff as signposted in their aisles. They introduced the pillow fort line of mostly gender neutral home goods and linens for kids. So I do think that that is changing. On the other hand, if gender reveal parties are becoming a bigger and bigger trend, then companies and manufacturers are going to glom onto that trend, just as they glommed onto every other trend in the baby industrial complex, whether it was the baby shower, the baby sprinkle, the push present, that was a big thing a few years ago, the baby moon. This is just another entrant in the category of how to get parents to be to spend money.
How does this trend relate to the HB2 controversy for you?
I think it's exceedingly rare that anyone would have a gender reveal party to kind of stick it to the trans rights movement. That is not what I think. That's not what I was trying to say in the piece. I do think that when fundamental cultural norms are being questioned, the way they are being questioned by the trans rights civil rights movement, I think social and cultural anxieties start percolating and bubbling up in really interesting ways. And it doesn't strike me as a coincidence that gender reveal parties are going viral at the same time that we're having this debate over whether or not people can use the bathroom that's right for them in North Carolina.
I was looking at one of the chalk exploding gender reveal photo shoots, along with some pointed critiques and heated arguments that followed in the comments threads, and thought, is it unfair to rain on an unexpected couple's parade by criticizing their gender enthusiasm, let's say, or if even posting that party footage online, they are inviting the debate?
I mean, I think the most important distinction to draw is between the personal and the cultural. I don't have any personal objections to people having gender reveal celebrations. If it floats your boat, if it makes your family happy, that's great. I think that can be made distinct from saying this is a very interesting cultural expression of a cultural anxiety, and let's talk about that and think about that. In terms of people leaving nasty comments online, that's just what people do. People will find any opportunity to leave a nasty comment online, so I don't think that's particular to this specific debate.
So Jessica, if invited to a gender reveal party, would you go?
Sure. I'd bring a present, and I would whoop with joy when the cake was cut, because that's what the parents wanted. And presumably, if I were invited to this party, they would be my friends, and I would want them to be happy. And I would just hope that they hadn't read the piece I'd already written about it.
Jessica Winter is features editor for Slate. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can check out her article, Are You a Boy or a Girl? There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know what you think. Did you or someone you know have a gender reveal party? Is that just another eye-rolling part of the baby industrial complex, or a fun tradition or excuse to have some friends over? What, if anything, crosses the line when it comes to celebrating sex or gender? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And now to another event typically fraught with expectation and loaded with societal pressure. That's right, it's wedding season, and by now, invitations are out, deposits paid, and hotels are booked for summer weddings. But what happens when someone decides not to go through with it?
Where's that guy? What's he doing? Take care of him.
He's too late.
Okay, we know how abruptly that wedding ended. Elaine ran off for an uncertain future with Benjamin in the Mike Nichols film, The Graduate. Contemporary couples are seeking less dramatic ways to share the bad news and possibly recoup some money by selling canceled wedding packages to other couples. Brooklyn-based novelist, columnist, and screenwriter Amy Sohn wrote for the New York Times Style section about how some couples are dealing with calling it quits before getting hitched. Amy Sohn, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So you talked with a few women who decided to cancel their weddings in the works. How did they talk about that decision with you?
Well, they all said that it was a very emotionally fraught decision, in part because the financial stakes were so high. I think that the ethical stakes have always been high in the sense that there's a certain amount of shame and social impropriety involved. But I call it the wedding industrial complex. It makes these things really, really complicated because how can you separate what your heart wants from all of those non-refundable deposits?
How many of these planned weddings don't come off?
Well, one study, which was a relatively small sample size of only about 1,200 couples, came up with a figure of 13% a year, which is about 250,000 weddings every year. Of course, it's hard to know. Could be much higher than that because many couples get engaged and don't talk about it. You know, how do you judge what qualifies as an engagement? Mm-hmm. But assuming that it's about 250,000, that's a lot of cancellation.
Well, the planning of weddings has become even more public. I know from Facebook, you know, I see where people are talking about the honeymoons they've planned or even posted samples of bands that they've booked for the wedding. Do you think it's even more mortifying to cancel a wedding than it was in the past when it was kind of secret?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the social media aspect of weddings to the point where you can hire a social media consultant for your wedding at, you know, $2,000 to $5,000 additional costs in addition to your band and your DJ and all the other things you're using. It means that these weddings are playing out in a very public way, beginning well before the actual event. There are not only save-the-date, you know, invitations that go out 6 or 8 months in advance of the wedding invitations, but you have engagement announcement videos where a camera is hidden as the question is popped, and then a lot of couples create videos of this, which they then send out as a way of announcing that they've gotten engaged, then chronicling every single step of wedding planning on social media, going to buy the dress, meeting the planner, picking out the floral. I mean, personally, to me, this would be like someone sharing with me like a dental hygiene diary. It's a part of the planning, which is to share it with everyone. And so what happens if a couple of months before the wedding, you suddenly decide that you don't want to do it, or worse, even far more humiliating, your spouse decides they don't want to marry you. Mm. And how do you chronicle that on social media? You have to change your status. Suddenly the photos, the wedding dress fittings become, you know, photos of the whiskey at the bottom of your glass as you're contemplating this very different future. So I think that the humiliation factor is greatly magnified by social media. And of course, there's a simple solution to this, which is that if you're less public about the planning, maybe it will be a little bit less humiliating if you cancel. But I don't think we're living in an age where that's an option.
Well, besides the image management, there's all this money. I mean, venues and photographers and videographers and wedding planners, they all get deposits. Are they used to this? Is that why they demand deposits?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of them, to be fair, are essentially small businesses. And the way they operate is on a calendar. And so once they book the day, they can't make money on that day if you cancel, say, you know, 7 or 8 weeks in advance, unless they can find someone else to fill the spot. But I do think it's a bit of a racket. I think there should be a better way where if they're able to recoup, in other words, if the vendor is able to find another couple, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a wedding couple, another event, and recoup the money, then they should refund the deposits. But unfortunately, that's not really how it works. The vendors control everything. The contracts are very strict, and there are vendors who will take the couples to court if the couple tries to get out of it. So it can get very, very ugly. And what's funny is that the big number seems to be the 90-day mark. You have a better chance of recouping a good percentage of your money if you cancel 91 days before.
Not to throw a wet blanket on wedding season, but we're talking with Amy Sohn, who's a screenwriter, novelist, and contributor to the New York Times Style section, who wrote about the aftermath of canceling a wedding, not just the social obligations, but how expensive it is. Well, I learned a lot of things reading this article, not the least of which was that wedding insurance is available. They do it for, you know, weather or military deployments or unexpected things. But now people can sell their abandoned wedding plans or packages to others. How does that work?
Yeah, there's a couple of sites that I found. One of them is called canceledweddings.com. I think this is actually the future, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Basically, you can sell your canceled event to another couple at an extremely discounted rate, and then the website, which serves as a kind of broker, takes a percentage. So we're already seeing this going on in the world of, you know, say if you have to cancel a hotel room or a plane reservation, why not let someone else take advantage of that? Why lose all the money just because your plans change? So I think that this is a really positive thing because it can be a bargain for other couples. The big question when it comes to weddings, as opposed to just a canceled hotel room, is do they feel that the date and the venue are cursed? And do they want to carry the emotional baggage of someone else's cancellation into their own wedding? Or are young couples sophisticated enough that they realize, hey, that's not my business, it's not my problem. If I can get 50% off, why not?
Well, you've also written about some kind of creative ways that brides or grooms, mostly brides, I think I've noticed, have kind of recouped their day. They've sort of rescued it from the dustbin by doing something else.
Yes, there are families that hold charity events. They do lunches for homeless children or families in need. There was a bride in Manhattan just this month who, I guess they could not work out the details of their prenuptial agreement. And so I don't know whether she canceled or he canceled, but it was decided that they would not get married. She was getting married at an event space on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and there was an $8,000 non-refundable deposit. And the bride decided to throw kind of an early Mother's Day celebration for underprivileged children and their mothers. And I think that is an amazing example of making lemonade out of lemons. Why throw the money away? At least let someone have fun that day if it's not going to be you. And what's wonderful about this story is that the bride attended. In some of these cases, the jilted party did not attend the event. The parents, you know, did some sort of charity event or that kind of thing. But the jilted party was in too much pain to be able to go. No. So I think that that's an extremely individualistic decision, whether you're able to kind of brush yourself off and attend your canceled wedding or just let your family and some other people enjoy it. But I think the real problem is that the marketplace is set up to be extremely strict. And I think that you could plan a wedding and do everything involved in it and just not call it a wedding, you could probably save 50% right off the bat. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you just hire a DJ and you tell them it's a party, they're going to quote you a rate significantly lower than if you tell them it's a wedding, even if the time commitment and everything else is exactly the same.
Well, Amy, you are a screenwriter, and there are some real stories of redemption in those that you write about here. Do I smell movie here? Is this a plot in the works?
Oh, well, didn't we already have a Runaway Bride with Julia Roberts?
That yeah, was a but we didn't one. Have the, you know, then she has a charity party with her deposit.
That's true. Yeah, I actually, the pop culture one that I liked the most was they had a wedding that was canceled on the show Transparent in the middle of the wedding. In other words, one of the two brides realized her regret at the actual reception, which is a pretty amazing story. I mean, not 6 months down the line, not a year down the line, but at her own party. And then she had a panic attack in the bathroom and was able to get a kind of annulment. But thanks for giving me that tip. I got to call my agent in Hollywood and maybe get out there and start pitching.
All right. I just require a small percentage. But thank you, Amy, so much for speaking
with us. Is it refundable?
Amy, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Great. My pleasure.
Amy Sohn, she's a Brooklyn-based novelist, columnist, and screenwriter. She's also a contributor to the New York Times Style section. And you really should take a look at her article, not just for the details, but also the fantastic illustration that one of the New York Times illustrators have come up with some samples of the kind of cards you'd send out if you canceled the wedding. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. And on this summer weekend, news that a new fitness craze may be coming to a pool near you. Mermaid schools are popping up in Paris, Montreal, Oahu, even in the heartland town of Midland, Michigan. Classes are generally pitched as part fitness and part fantasy, or in the case of Aqua Mermaid School in Chicago, both. It looks like a hearty workout for the abs, and it's a popular new option for bachelorette and bridal parties and women and girls nostalgic for Splash or The Little Mermaid, depending on their demographic.
I'm telling you a tale of the bottomless blue and its hay to the starboard heave-ho. Look up, lad, a mermaid be waiting for you in mysterious fathoms below.
I'm Virginia Prescott. From all of us here at Word of Mouth, we hope you're enjoying your holiday weekend. We'll be back Monday at 2 with more Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.